There's an old cliche that says that practice makes perfect. While practice might not result in perfection, our practices always shape and form us. James K.A. Smith has said that whether we are young or old, our practices function as liturgies in our lives. These liturgies can either promote our spiritual growth and development, or they can form us in a direction away from God, sometimes without even knowing it. We'll be chatting with Jamie Smith about our cultural liturgies and his new book, You Are What You Love, and what that means for students, parents, and youth workers on this episode of Youth Culture Matters.
From the Center for Parent Youth Understanding, this is Youth Culture Matters. If you're a parent, youth worker, educator, counselor, grandparent, or anyone else who cares about kids, we're glad you've joined us for this practical, informative, and hope-filled podcast. This is a place where together we talk and think Christianly about the rapidly changing world of today's children, teens, and young adults.
We are back for another episode of Youth Culture Matters. I'm Walt Mueller at the Center for Parent Youth Understanding. And as always, I've got Jason Sochenik.
Yes.
I've got nothing snarky.
As always.
I'll just say Jason Sochenik.
Honestly, it's a privilege and honor to be here on another podcast.
No, I'm talking about me being snarky, not you.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. I appreciate you not being snarky.
I say I have nothing snarky. I just want to say it's Jason Sochenik. From Spokane, Washington,
LaWalt.
With Project 619.
Yes.
We appreciate your work, Jason, really. I love what you do.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, on sexual integrity. So people need to check that out. We include links to CPYU and to Project 619 on the homepage for the podcast, Youth Culture Matters at cpyu.org. And so check that out. And
they should check out Project619.org, SIX19.org, especially here in the next few weeks. We're going to be launching our brand new website, so we're pretty stoked.
Anything exciting going to be on the website? What are the new features?
Well, yeah, new features. That's a great question. Honestly, what we've done is in the past, our website has been much more information, what we offer, what we talk on, but we're moving to a place where we're going to offer a lot more resources, so downloads, books, things that you can also get on the sexualintegrityinitiative.com. But we also will be launching our new curricula, Greater Than Sex, Greater Than Porn, and then making available our school curricula, which is Life Up Close. So those are just some of the things. And then we're launching a couple of other initiatives over the next several months, some of which you'll be a part of, and others that I'll be creating on our own. We will be starting another podcast specifically exploring the complexities around sex and sexuality as a Christian. So we're excited for that.
Oh, good. Am I co-hosting that podcast? I don't remember you asking me about that yet.
No, but you will be coming on frequently, I think. So.
Yeah. I was waiting, and I just thought, you know, you could have done that publicly in front of everybody here.
Oh,
it's not happening.
I apologize. You kind of make me feel like the individual that was telling you about a wedding that I've got coming up and I'm getting married, and you expect for me to ask you to come and stand on up front with me to be a groomsman.
I made you feel like that?
Kind of.
Yeah, mission accomplished.
And now you're like, so wait.
Mission
accomplished. You're not going to invite me to be a groomsman?
Mission accomplished. Yeah. Oh, I like messing with you. You know what?
I know you
I'm
do.
Really, I'm glad we've gotten to know each other. This is fun doing this together. You know,
it is. This is a blast.
Yep. And I'll tell you what, I'm just going to say this right at the outset, that anything we talk about on the podcast, because sometimes we forget to say this, just, again, go to the CPYU homepage and look at, or you have this loaded onto Project 619, so people could access it there. But look at you with your new website. But look at all the connects and the links we have. So if you are hearing something, you go, man, I wish I had heard that, and you play it back, you're not sure what it was, just go. All the links are there. You can click through all the books, all the studies, all the research, all the stories. Everything is there. So one thing that we're glad is not there are the questions and the quizzes that Kenton and Chris give to us.
That's right.
Yeah, we just try. This is the part where we say, okay, we have to do this. Because this is what keeps these guys on their toes and interested in what we're talking about.
It keeps us on our toes.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's usually a question or a quiz.
We have a question for you.
Okay,
today.
Quiz, Chris.
Question.
Oh, yes. Question.
Yep.
Question.
All right, either.
I keep hoping for a quiz. Why?
We'll get
you
a quiz.
You do.
There's been a lot of talk about space travel, traveling to Mars, the SpaceX project, all that kind
boy,
of stuff.
You guys know how I feel about science fiction. Yeah, this is going to...
No, it's pretty... If you were...
This isn't science fiction. This is reality.
Well, it's leading down that road. Someday. As soon as you say space and space travel, now I'm thinking...
It's not that. Don't worry. You're
okay, right.
So let's say you're on one of those first missions to Mars.
Yeah.
You're allowed to take one item with you. And I'm going to make it easy. It cannot be the Bible or any other book. So we're eliminating that. You can take one item with you. What item would that be?
Silence.
I have no idea. What?
I honestly
have no idea. I would take the internet. Item. Can you take the internet? I don't know. I just thought of it. What? One?
That's
do you have anything,
answer.
Jason?
No, that's
what would
a good
you take?
Answer. I was thinking. Well, you take your computer or a smartphone, but it actually is useless without the
right.
internet. I mean, it's
unless,
not useless
unless they have cell towers up on Mars.
Yeah.
I mean, do they have that? Or I know there's satellites up there, but do they reach that far? See this now.
Who knows?
This is what's exactly where I thought this question would go. We're heading into the world of science fiction now because how do we know?
Well, what about that framed portrait of myself that I gave to you a couple years back?
Yeah, well, that's now you're putting me on a spot like I put Jason on the spot. I don't have that anymore. Ken, do you have that? Did you see that over at Goodwill or?
I did not.
Okay, right.
No,
you'll have to go back and look because that's where it wound up.
So what you're saying is Chris's picture is floating around Elizabethtown at the Goodwill.
I have no idea where it is. I need some help here. Somebody needs to give me a hint. I'm speechless. I mean, what would you take to Mars? Just
hint.
One item.
This isn't – you're asking us to answer your question.
I'm assuming –
You're asking us to answer for you. We can't tell you what to take to Mars. You're going to have to decide on your own. You're a
These
big
guys
boy.
Tell me other things all the time. They can tell me what to take to Mars. Am I coming back?
I don't know.
You don't know the answer to that question.
All right.
You may or may not end up back.
All right.
I can't even come up with anything, Chris.
What are you taking? What are you taking?
I'm just thinking off the top of my head, but I know exactly what I'm taking. I'm taking my phone with a recording of Game 7 of the World Series with the Cubs versus the Indians when the Cubs took it home, baby. Yeah, that I could watch that over and over and over and over
this.
Again. It's so good.
Yeah.
That's a good
answer.
There you go. That's
this.
My answer.
That's a good answer.
I will forever be without a voice because I will be cheering on my Cubs throughout all 10 innings that took place in Game 7. I mean, as a bonus, if I could have the entire series, that would be pretty awesome. But
that was disappointing
that
to me
game.
That they were not good enough to finish it out in 9 innings.
Hey, my heart would have liked them to finish it in 9. But the sports fan and the sports fan in me loves games like this. I mean, I could not have written a better ending to the season, to our 108-year drought. Like, that was perfect. Down 3-1, come back, game 7, 10th inning, rain delay, pitching changes that shouldn't have happened.
I think
I
have my answer.
Should still be pitching.
Yeah, yeah. I would take Jason's cell phone with Game 7 of the World Series on it so that he wouldn't be able to have it. Because if we both went, and I met up with him, problem solved.
All right, touche.
Do you like that one?
Yeah, that was good. That's good.
I can't think of anything. I mean, I'm thinking food now. You know, that's what you always go to. Well, like, what will they not have on Mars?
Well, I know. Well, let's be honest. I know what you would take. You would take a recording of when you were in the National League Championship Series against the Giants and you lost. That's what you probably would take with the Phillies and the Giants, right? Was that Game 6?
No, Chris is going to say that I'd take a recording of the last game of the 2009 World Series when the Yankees beat the Phillies.
Hideki Matsui, 6 RBI.
That was, and that was brutal because I had to come in here the next day. I had to face him the next day.
Oh, that's pretty tough. I hope that he was from head to toe in Yankees garb.
Other people might disagree, but I'm a pretty graceful team winner.
You were, but the clothing thing, that does, yeah. I mean, like, you have a Yankees license plate, Yankees jacket. Best one was, did we ever tell you this one, Jason? When we went to a Phillies Brewers playoff game in 2000.
That's correct.
Was that 2008? That was the year they won it all, yes. So we go down there to Citizens Bank Park. Now, understand, I'm from Philly. These are Philly fans. Have we talked about this on the podcast yet?
I don't know.
And so we go down, the four of us. Lisa's there, Chris, and then one of your college buddies went. Josh, right?
That's right.
And we get out of the car, and we've got to walk through the tailgate lot at Citizens Bank Park. And let me just say, the tailgate lot, whenever there's a tailgate at a Philly sports event, you can assume that that is the most dangerous place on the face of the earth at that moment in time. And he gets out of the car.
Oh, I walked through it. I know.
It was so funny because he gets out of the car. He's got a Yankees jersey. The Yankees aren't even playing. And he gets out of the car, and Lisa says to him, "I'm not defending you." That was funny in and of itself. If anything happens here, Lisa says, "If anything happens, I'm not defending you," which that just lets you know what she thinks of Chris already, that she's going to have to come to your defense. Like, you can't defend yourself. She has to defend you. And she says, "I'm not going to defend you." And as soon as she's done saying that, it starts. He's walking through the parking lot, and the taunts were brutal. I walked several steps behind and just watched because I thought something would happen. It didn't, but it just was.
Yeah, there were some dicey trips to the bathroom.
It was. Why would you do that? I mean, that's like.
Why wouldn't I support my team? That's the question.
You know what that's like?
Why wouldn't I support my team?
But I would liken I would liken that to like going to a dog pound where the dogs haven't been fed for 3 weeks and like rubbing ground meat all over your body before you go in and then walking in. It's just like inviting.
It's called integrity. I have the same.
That's right.
I root for my team no matter what, whether it's up,
that's
down.
Right.
Okay, integrity.
I appreciate
involved.
This.
I was thinking of another word that ends with itty.
If you want to, I mean, I appreciate what Chris is saying because, you know, we had Jeremy Affeldt on a podcast.
Yes, we did. That was a good one.
And without going into a lot of detail, let's just say he was on a NL Central team, not the Cubs, and I wore a Cubs hat to that game.
As you
and
should.
To his, and because I'm a loyal fan. Now.
And you sat in the family section too, didn't you? The Giants family section.
Yeah, that was
you sat there.
It was bad. It was bad.
I mean, there it is.
There's
another
loyal.
Word that
was,
ends with itty. Right there.
I would say that I might not have been honoring my friend, and I might have actually made a bad choice, but I don't think about that because I am loyal to my team. I love the Cubs. I have always been a Cubs fan. It doesn't mean that I don't like the individuals pitching on the other team. It just means that I was born and bred to be a Cubs fan. And, yeah, I'll leave it there.
All right.
Anyways. Well, so with that, we probably need to transition into some news and trends.
How do you know I'm done?
Alerts.
How do you know I'm done with this?
Do you have anything else to add?
I'm done. Enough's been said. People will come to conclusions that I know I can trust and agree with. So,
I'm just trying to save you because
Chris is
now you
ticked.
Have my phone and you're going to be watching Game 7 of the World Series.
Are you ticked? Chris is looking
multiple
ticked.
Times.
Yeah. No, stop joking. We're not even drawing awesome. Kenton into this conversation because his loyalties are so all over the place. It's not even funny.
I will say this just as an observational thing. It is telling that your answers were actually digital things.
Yeah.
You had the choice to bring one physical item along with you, and neither of you actually chose a physical item.
Well, I was thinking.
I mean, the cell phone itself, I guess, but or whatever device you're using. But the gist of your answer was a digital file.
Yeah. Well, I thought if there was such a thing as a perpetual pizza, like when you remove a slice, the slice is automatically replicated, or I would take that because, you know, you want to take a food item that's something you enjoy. Yeah,
perpetual pizza. Maybe that will be a thing by the time we go to Mars.
Well, and this is the first place you heard it. So if anybody invents that, yeah, the proceeds need to go to CPYU. All right, you're going to get us started with some of what's happening.
Yeah, I'll get us started. I'll get us started on the 2-minute drill.
And you're going to finish this crazy conversation. Oh, boy, here we go.
Yeah, we are. Well, oddly enough, you know, where I'm going to start is actually with Anthony Rizzo, who plays first base for the Cubs, which I'm extremely excited, won the World Series, if you couldn't already tell. And, you know, I just thought, gosh, what a great story. Since I found a way to bring the Cubs in to our conversation, why not continue it? So if you don't know about this, in the National League Championship Series against the Dodgers, the Los Angeles Dodgers, Rizzo had a moment with the umpire, got really upset, as do a lot of batters when they feel like they've got a bad call at the plate. Got upset, said a few things, but then he did something that I've just never seen before. I'm sure it happens, at least I hope it does, but I remember watching this on national TV, and then I came across an article that was talking about it, and it was him coming up before he even stepped up to the plate to apologize to the ump for his attitude, to apologize for getting upset. And I love the umpire's response. The umpire said this, your fault for what? Because he said, that was my fault. That was my bad. I got upset. And he says, your fault for what, brother? Come on. You're good, bro. You're awesome with us. No worries. You're competing. I understand. Don't worry. You know what's best of it is you came back here to tell me that. And that's how good of a guy you are. Now, I don't know anything else about Rizzo, but I really appreciated the response and then the apology. It's just something we don't see in major league sports. And I just really love that it was a Cub coming up and apologizing. Here's the thing that I took away from it, which I think is really important. He did it in person. He didn't wait until afterwards. I've seen a lot of individuals apologize afterwards only after pressure was mounted. He kept it simple. He did it at the next at bat, so he did it as soon as he could, and he owned his mistake. I just don't see this happening a lot in major league sports. So I was loving seeing Rizzo, someone from my Cubs, step up and do this. And by the way, they were also pretty humble when they won the title.
Yeah, good example for kids, that's for sure. And I, Jason, you and I talked about this. This is a good story. And just because of that, I need to apologize to you and Chris for harassing you for your loyalties.
Go Yankees.
No, thank you for that. You don't owe us an apology. Well, you're all good. You're good with me, man. When it gets into competing, I totally understand. That's how good of a guy you are.
I know there's an asterisk on the end of that somewhere. I got to scroll down to see what that means. But, well, hey, here's something we need to be concerned about, and that is we've talked before a lot about kids and alcohol, risk-taking behavior related to that. And we've talked at other times as well about kids and these caffeinated, brightly colored, packaged energy drinks, you know, and they come in all sorts of shapes, sizes, flavors, and under all kinds of brand names. And there's been some research done on what happens in the adolescent brain, which, by the way, is in process. But what happens in the adolescent brain when kids engage in the risky behavior of drinking a caffeinated energy drink along with alcohol, mixing it with alcohol. And I will just say this, that the research they've come up with now has said that this combination of things can be as brutal on the brain and stimulate changes in the adolescent brain that would be similar to what happens when the adolescent brain is engaged with cocaine. Now, the research was not done on human subjects. It was done, I believe, on mice, adolescent mice. This is kind of funny that the adolescent mouse brain mirrors the adolescent brain pretty well, so that's why all the research is done on adolescent mice. But again, the reason we bring this up is, parents, this is, again, where we have to have some knowledge, know what your kids are doing, understand what some of the trends are. They talk amongst themselves. There's pressure to do these things. They hear about it. They try it. And this the very same brain that is not fully formed until about the age of 25 years old that The last part to form is the part that's responsible for impulse control and decision making, executive functioning. The very brain that lets them down is the brain that's going to be harmed by this kind of behavior. So keep an eye out for this. Talk about it and warn your kids about it.
Most definitely.
Wow. Prize.
Excellent. Wow, we're doing good here. Well, one of the things that is a that I've seen a lot of companies picking up on, especially in the beauty industry, is the beauty tech product. And one of the individuals getting into the game is Panasonic. Panasonic is partaking in the beauty tech industry by finding ways to help keep us youthful. And one of the things that they've done is they've created this smart mirror. And the smart mirror is interactive. It takes your image. So you look into your phone, your computer, whatever it is, takes an image of your face, and then points out all of your flaws. And for me, it would be plenty, but it takes all of our flaws. And then what it does is it recommends what to do with makeup or to touch up your face. And what then happens is it moves to a computer, a printer, that would actually print off makeup onto some sort of printed good. And then you take it, and it's almost like a mask that you would put over your face, but it would be the makeup itself to help fix it. So instead of you applying it yourself, it's done through this process of printing based upon the image that it saw. And I just think these are the stories that always kind of make me think, gosh, man, in our pursuit to be young, in our pursuit to be something that maybe we are not, it really makes me wonder, okay, what are we ultimately trying to do? Are we trying to just stay young? Are we trying to step into something that is not us, or is this something that can be? Is this something that, I guess the question I ask is, to be used for the glory of God? And I don't know. I think that one of the things we have to be aware of is that these are the things that make me point back to: we are made in the image of a Creator. We are made to express the beauty of who He is through the way that we live and the way that we look. And I just think that sometimes these are the things that we become so focused on the flaws rather than the beauty of how we were created in His image.
Yeah. And the identity messages there that our culture is sending, so much pressure on our kids, and we've got to watch
Most
this.
Definitely.
I mean, if you're a parent and you're going, wow, this is a great invention, I've got to plug into this, you're sending some pretty negative messages to your kids about what's most important in life. So, yeah, that is that. Boy, talk about technology and how we use it. That's a crazy
something straight out of like the Jetsons.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It's crazy.
Yep, it's like something you'd have on Mars. I might
That's
have to
right.
take this with me to Mars. That'd be an amazing thing to take. So,
in case you meet an
yeah,
alien.
I want to go back. I want to go back to the brain here because there's so much tremendous research being done on the human brain, and you talk about the glory of God, the way He made us. It's just stunning when you start to look at the research and the science on the human brain. And much of what we're learning about the brain and concussions, and especially as that's related to youth football, that's troubling. A new study has come out that some are saying will really get parents rethinking whether or not kids should be playing youth football. There's 3 million children in the United States who play in tackle football programs. And we've talked a lot in the past about concussions. There's a lot of research being done on that. But new research from the Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center is studying the impact of less serious blows to the head that are the kinds of blows that are more common during regular contact in a game or regular contact if there's contact in practice. And they looked at players between the ages of 8 and 13. Each of the boys was outfitted with a helmet that measured the severity and frequency of head blows. And basically, what we know that came out of the research was this, that when they performed MRIs on the players, it was determined that there were, after the hits, some changes in the brain's white matter, and that's the issue that connects the gray matter in the brain. The reason I pass this on is this is worth watching. I really think changes are coming in youth football. I wonder about it at higher levels. There's so much still that's unknown, but there's a lot that we are learning. There was a story recently that came out about a football player from one of my favorite professional teams, the Philadelphia Eagles, Kevin Turner, who played over a decade ago died recently, and he had ALS, and they did donate his brain to the group up at Boston University. And when they examined it, they did find that he had CTE, that's chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which is indicative of taking a lot of blows to the head. Unfortunately, that cannot be diagnosed until after death, but that's a story worth watching. And we need to be diligent and look out for the safety of our kids, especially when it comes to youth sports during the younger developmental years.
Yeah. Well, and just looking out for the safety of our kids, the last issue that I really want for us to be able to address, but this article, the study that I came across, is one that is striking on two reasons. It was a study that looked at sixth graders committing cyber abuse, but cyber abuse against their dating partners, which, first, cyber abuse is a growing issue that I see both in elementary schools and middle schools and also high schools. So I said both, but really it's all three. Really, fifth grade all the way through 12th grade, I'm seeing abuse taking place through social media, texting. It's not something that's necessarily new, but it's growing. But then the other striking thing is that the report points to sixth graders that are dating.
That's
and
crazy.
So it is crazy. And so I don't know if for purposes of this study, they designed it and they defined it in a particular way. Maybe it's just they had a romantic relationship. Maybe they were interested. I'm not exactly sure, but it was striking to me. I just think that we need to pay attention to this, though, because there is an increase in abuse that's happening through social media, and specifically abuse among dating partners, not just in sixth grade, but other studies have shown that this is happening more and more in middle school and in high school. And I just think that we've got to understand that this is a growing trend, that this is not something that's changing. And so we need to be advocates. We need to start creating interventions. We need to start doing really good education around what it means to step into a relationship for it to be healthy, and specifically for it to be God-honoring. If we are in the church or if we are in the home, so often we can have conversations around relationships but not go into how they are necessarily practiced, specifically online. And I think that these are things that we need to be aware of. Studies like this allow for us to recognize our conversations need to look a little bit different than they might have 10 years ago because of the use of technology. So when we're having conversations around relationships and healthy relationships, godly relationships, let's make sure we're also talking about how that is practiced, not only in person, but online.
Hmm. Well, finally, I want to mention some research that's related to that because it's about technology and screens. And this comes from the American Academy of Pediatrics. They have issued standards and parameters, suggestions on that for the last few years, and they have now reissued some new standards and parameters as technology develops for parents to institute with their kids. Some strong recommendation about the quantity and quality of media that children and teens consume on a daily basis. The new recommendations, and parents should listen to this, the new recommendations call for infants, those who are younger than 18 to 24 months, to be kept away from all media and all screens except for video chatting. And so, you know, like when grandma calls or grandpa calls, and, you know, we do that, the FaceTime thing with our grandkids when we're not with them. Now, after those ages, the recommendation is that they may be exposed to it, but with content that should be high quality. And there are organizations, Common Sense Media being one. You can find them at commonsensemedia.org, who will screen some of the media and be able to make recommendations on what is high quality media. But they're also saying that children after 2 years of age, young children shouldn't be left alone when they're engaging with any sort of digital media or television. In other words, we need to monitor that, which would, in the case of what you just talked about, Jason, with the abuse, the cyber abuse, would be a great way, you know, to steer kids away from that if you see that they're actually engaging in that. So, again, for preschool-age children, and I know we have some of those moms and those dads listening, the guidelines from the American Academy of Pediatrics recommend limiting screen use to 1 hour per day of high-quality programming. So make sure you track with that. And I know it's an easy way to, you're tired as parents and you just want to have some downtime, put the kids in front of the screen, let the screen babysit, but it does do damage. And we need to think about that when our kids are young, because it's going to be too late to think about when they're older and it's already done its work. So, boy, these are important stories for us, important trends, important youth culture. issues that we need to be aware of. And so youth workers, we want to encourage you. Parents, we want to encourage you. Be aware of what's happening out there and develop strategies to derail the kids away from the negative and take them towards things that are good, true, right, and honorable. And you will find those things in culture from time to time. But again, Jason and I are trying to give you some thinking points and some talking points that would be really helpful. Well, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to have a conversation with someone who I highly respect, who I think could be one of the most important voices that parents and youth workers, certainly pastors and others who work with kids, need to be listening to. It's James K.A. Smith. He's referred to. It's okay with us calling him Jamie. That's what he gets called. Jamie Smith is a professor at Calvin College, professor of philosophy. He's also the editor of Comment Magazine. He's written numerous books, and we're going to talk about his latest book, which is titled You Are What You Love. So stick with us and come back for a very practical, and I think it's going to be a winsome conversation about something that matters deeply. Stick with us. We'll be right back after this break. In an effort to help you help the kids you know and love navigate their emerging sexuality to the glory of God, we've launched a sexual integrity initiative here at CPYU. Thanks to a generous grant from a company called DAS, you can access our sexual integrity initiative and a growing number of resources for free by visiting the website at sexualintegrityinitiative.com. Well, welcome back, everybody, to this episode of Youth Culture Matters. And Jason, I am pretty excited about what we're going to talk about, and even more so who we're going to talk to now. Jamie Smith is a professor of philosophy at Calvin College out there in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Arch rivals of Hope College, I know that. There's quite a rivalry there in college basketball. And he is the Gary and Henrietta Biker Chair in Applied Reformed Theology and Worldview. I know that sounds like a lot, but he is someone who I really respect as a cultural critic and a go-to in terms of what he's writing and what he's thinking about. He's written a lot for magazines, Wall Street Journal, newspapers too, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Slate, First Things, Christianity Today, Books and Culture, and The Hedgehog Review. And then he's also now the editor-in-chief of a magazine that I would love for all our youth worker friends to plug into, and that's Comment Magazine, and we'll include a link to that. I may have to ask about this. He and his wife, Deanna, are elementary school sweethearts. They've got four kids, and much to my delight, Jamie used to live in Philadelphia. I may have to ask about that, too, because I'm a Philly guy. We talk about that a lot here. So, Jamie, welcome.
Hi.
I'm excited to talk about this this book, which to me is the latest in a long, long series of books. We'll mention some of them later, that I have absolutely loved. We've had students read them. We're trying to get them in the hands of youth workers. This latest one is called You Are What You Love, and I'd love to hear just a little bit of your own story and how you got to the point where you wrote this and what was beating through your veins and your head and your heart when you wrote this book, You Are What You Love.
Thanks. It's great to talk to you about it, and thanks for your interest. You Are What You Love is a book that I didn't know I would write. I'm an academic. I'm a scholar. I do French philosophy that six other people in the world care about. But it turns out that there was this sort of philosophical trajectory of thinking about human nature that propelled me into a whole series of reflections on Christian formation, discipleship, and worship. And so I started working that out in a book called Desiring the Kingdom, which got a lot more attention than I ever would have imagined. And I suppose the story here is that when I wrote Desiring the Kingdom, I thought it was a popular level book. But it turns out that any book that has, 485 footnotes is not considered a popular level book. what we found is as we started teasing out these ideas about why we are what we love and why our desires define us, there was just a lot of uptake and interest and traction on the ground, so to speak, and in the pews. And so You Are What You Love was my attempt to sort of translate that for a wider audience and get to think about some things I hadn't been able to talk about before in terms of family, children, youth, schooling, work, things like that. So it's been it was a lot of fun to write, but it was also a lot of it was a big challenge for me because it's so different than academic writing.
Yeah. And those first I shouldn't say your first two books because I know you have a variety of books, but Desiring the Kingdom, published by Baker. There's a little tagline on there: Cultural Liturgies, Volume 1, and then Imagining the Kingdom, Cultural Liturgies, Volume 2. Talk just that word liturgy. I know that in my world of youth ministry, and I think maybe in the church at large, you know, people who don't come from a quote-unquote liturgical background, and I know everything's a liturgy in church, but people who don't come from that think of that as a sometimes a dirty negative word. I love the way you use it. I think people need to understand it. Talk a little bit about your thoughts on liturgies and why you use that.
So think of it this way. In a sense, every youth pastor is an ethnographer, right? That is, what I mean is, imagine how central the work of cultural criticism is to the work of youth ministry. I mean, so much of it is sort of discerning culture and the unique opportunities and threats and challenges that come with that. And what I found was a lot of the kind of Christian framework for that cultural criticism was fueled by what I would call a worldview kind of paradigm, which is great. I'm very pro worldview, but what happens is if you sort of look at culture through the lens of worldview, what you tend to do is listen for messages and ideas and propositions and arguments, and what I worried about is we were missing, in fact, all kinds of cultural dynamics that weren't trying to change our minds, they were trying to capture our hearts. So in that sense, what's at stake in our cultural immersion and participation isn't that you might run into some ideas that make you believe the wrong things. It's that you're getting sucked into rhythms and routines and rituals that are at a very sort of almost subconscious level teaching you to love the wrong things. And so I kind of try to use this word liturgy. I'm trying to redeem the term, but I'm also trying to expand it, stretch it, as a way to talk about love-shaping practices. It's basically a shorthand term for cultural rituals, cultural routines that aren't benign, that aren't just neutral. They're not just something that you do. They're doing something to you. Mm. And that's sense, If liturgies are love-shaping practices and routines that are doing something to you, then in fact, there are liturgies everywhere, right? Like this is so not something that's confined to the four walls of the church. There is something religious at stake in the cultural practices that are shaping our hearts.
And as you said, we never think about those. I like the way you say it. We think that they're neutral or benign or they have no effect on us. You, in the book, you talk about, and I thought this was brilliant because it really captures what, if any of us have been watching culture, we see this, but I love the way you explained it with consumerism and the liturgy of the mall. Use that as an example. Explain how that works because that's powerful.
And this comes from my experience with my own kids. When I really started thinking about these things, they were all teenagers. And we used to have this sort of inside joke where whenever the kids wanted me to take them to the mall, they would say, "Dad, would you take us to the temple?" And they're sort of mocking me as they're doing this, right? But I was okay with it because it was actually a sign that they remembered something we talked about, which is I tried to explain to them, look, the mall is the most religious site in any city. And that's not because it's offering a theology per se. It's not like you walk into the mall and they say, "Oh, well, here's the 16 things the mall believes." But It's the rituals and liturgies and litanies of consumerism that are sort of co-opting us just by the very form of the practice, right? So you're not, the mall's not trying to change your mind. You don't become a consumerist because somebody argues you to a conclusion. It's because the stories, images, practices, rituals of consumerism in marketing, in the mall, in social media are kind of painting a picture of what we start to imagine is the good life. And that's what we want. And that's what we live towards. And so without even realizing it, because it's not working on our head, it's working on our heart, we get co-opted into this gospel of consumerism whose cathedral is the mall.
So as you talk about that, and I was reading this, I was thinking about a conversation I had with a young mother one time where she had had a particularly difficult week with her kids. She had had a particularly difficult week with, I think, her parents and with other people. And in her email lament to me, this is someone I knew, at the end, the concluding word was, "I'm going to the mall. I need some retail therapy."
Yeah.
So that's the outcome you're talking about, right?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Exactly. I mean, think of the mall. Put on this kind of ritual lens, right? Or put on a set of liturgical glasses and look at the mall through that perspective. And all of a sudden, you start to see how much it is a kind of quasi-church reality, right? So the evangelism of the mall is called marketing. And it is fantastic because it knows that we are narrative creatures. It knows that we are imaginative animals. And so the way that they pull you in is not by giving you information that changes your mind. It's by painting stories, and you want to be a character in that story. And so now you show up, and the walls of the mall are lined with the icons of the good life, which are the mannequins who are wearing whatever is the latest. I'm not even going to try to say that. I never know what's hip and current right now.
At one point, it was
American
day.
Eagle, but yeah. So imagine. I mean, think of if you went to York Minster Cathedral or Westminster Abbey. The stained glass was the sort of wallpaper of worship that told us the story of the saints that we were to emulate. Well, now look at all those mannequins that are lining the labyrinthine corridors of the mall and realize that those are doing the same thing. They're saying, this is what the good life looks like. So we get and then the cash register is the altar. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's where the consummation of the event happens. But of course, we also know that this is a big lie, because you go for your retail therapy because something dazzling and bright and shiny and new is finally going to make you happy for about a week and a half, and then you need the next new thing. So this is where it's a false promise, and it sucks us into ways of life that are destructive. It's what Augustine would call disordered love, right? Yeah. It's a signal that we're lovers. It's a signal that we're hungering for something. But what it does is it keeps offering us substitutes for what our heart is really hungry for.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say. You know, I think about when I talk to youth workers about marketing, when you add to that planned obsolescence, that what is in today, like, you know, you said American Eagle. I mean, know what's hip today. And, you know, how do you keep up with that? It's constantly changing. And I think marketers, as you've said, they understand the results of the fall. They may not be able to explain that theologically, but that yearning, that groaning, that hunger that we have to be redeemed, we just keep going to all the wrong places. Yeah, these liturgies are powerful.
And marketers know that we're not just thinking things. They know we're not just brains on a stick. That's why they're not trying to convince us with arguments. Yeah. They're trying to capture our imagination with stories and narratives that kind of pluck our heartstrings. And I mean, I think this is true of all kinds of temptations, if you will, or it's true of all kinds of disordered ways of life, that the way we get sucked into them is not because we start thinking the wrong thoughts, it's because we start wanting the wrong things.
Wow. There's a couple of things that I just really love about what you're saying in here. First, would the mall, the liturgy of the mall, be interchangeable then with something like social media, where you have this dynamic of a generation that isn't necessarily using the mall as much as it once did? So is it interchangeable?
I think there is a resonance between the two, although I think if you do this kind of liturgical analysis of social media, there's some slightly different dynamics that are emphasized. One is what the philosopher Charles Taylor calls a culture of mutual display. So what happens is we live in this age in which I am only to the extent that I am seen. Right, I am valued to the extent that I show something that captures people's attention. And that's why I always have to be on, I always have to be broadcasting, I need my Snapchat story going. So there's this weird dynamic that social media where to be is to be seen. And so now we have to market ourselves almost to everyone to get their attention. But the flip side of this, and I've seen this in young people, is it actually creates this paralyzing self-consciousness, because now you're always being watched. When we were young, self-consciousness is a natural part of being 14. Do you know what I mean? You walk up the stairs at the football game and you imagine everybody there is looking at you, which is never true. Yeah. But that's natural. That's totally natural. But at least we could go home. And it was, no matter how much we might have been jerks to our parents or whatever, we actually could be safe because we knew we didn't have to be on and we weren't being watched. But that's not true for young people now. You're never not on, right? You're always being watched. And I think that's a really I'm so glad I'm not 14 today. Like, I really, really ache for people who have to live in this kind of constant self-imposed media attention. So I think that's one side. The other side we could talk about too is I do think there's something about the kind of the unique rituals that characterize smartphone technology that the smartphone is like the rituals of it. It almost doesn't matter what content is. The very ritual of it is sort of an egoism machine, because what it teaches me is I should never be bored. I should never not want to do something. The whole world should be available to me on my terms, on my fingertips, when I want it. And I think that has this kind of – we sort of curve in upon ourselves. And I think there's some pretty destructive characteristics of that.
Mm. Boy, wow.
This is really good. I think that one of the things that I want some clarification only in the fact that when you come to this idea of liturgy, as we're going to be going to a break here in a moment, but I want to hear real quick, when you are talking liturgy and worldview, because you had started this by saying pro-worldview, are you saying liturgy is expanding the way that it's another way working alongside, or it's another way to think about this, or is it something separate that we need to consider in participation with the dynamic of worldview?
That's a great question. It's a very important question. I see these as working in tandem, and here's how I imagine it. A worldview analysis is helpful because it helps us to realize that, in a sense, everything matters. Do you know what I mean? Like, we need to bring a Christian perspective to the entirety of our lives, and therefore it also wakes us up to why culture matters and so on. My only concern is that a worldview analysis still tends to kind of focus on what we think and believe and know, right? Your perspective on things. So I'm just supplementing that because I think that we are more than thinkers. I think we are more than what we know. And I actually think our loves and our longings and desires define us more than our beliefs and knowledge and ideas. Mm. And so if we take that's why I think scripture always talks about the heart, right?
Yeah.
And so if we take that seriously, then we just need to expand the scope of our cultural analysis, expand our cultural radar, so to speak, to start picking up on the practices and routines that aren't trying to change my mind, but are trying to capture my heart.
Mm-hmm. Wow. This is good.
Yeah.
This is really good. Jamie, thank you. Well, let us take a break. We're going to take a quick break, And then we're going to come back in just a moment, because I want to continue on some of this conversation, because I'm really appreciating a lot of what you're sharing. So we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Here at CPYU, we're taking steps to help parents, youth workers, educators, and anyone else who cares about kids help the kids they know and love navigate the difficult issues of life. We've put together a one-day training seminar called Tackling the Tough Stuff that we can bring to your community. Over the course of the day, Marth Penner and I will provide information and practical steps you can take to address narcissism, pornography, self-injury, depression, suicide, and a variety of other tough issues kids face in today's world. To learn more about bringing Tackling the Tough Stuff to your church or community, go to cpyu.org/toughstuff or call us at 1-800-807-CPYU. Welcome back, everybody, to this episode of Youth Culture Matters. We are having a great conversation with Jamie Smith. He's a professor of philosophy at Calvin College, and he's the author of several books that I've been able to read. The one that we're talking about today is You Are What You Love, which I think, a subtitle, by the way, The Spiritual Power of Habit. Honestly, I'm putting this on my list of, you know, must-read books for youth workers. We're trying to get youth workers and parents to read all the time. And folks, this is one that definitely is worth your time. I'm just going to mention, Jamie, real quick, that two of the books that I read that, you know, I don't know how much traction they've gotten outside of your circles, but Letters to a Young Calvinist and Invitation to the Reformed Tradition. People who aren't familiar with the Reformed tradition, don't fasten your seatbelt and push back on this. This is one that's worth reading. It's an excellent book. And then a book that I think, as I remember reading this was really geared towards folks within your circles there with the CRC, is Discipleship in the Present Tense, Reflections on Faith and Culture, which is a series of articles that are just fantastic. And I think youth workers would be challenged by these and could actually teach from these. It's a very, very good book, and I've got lots of notes in there. But before we get back to talking about You Are What You Love, one of the things we love here is to put people like you on the spot. So we do this little thing we call Take Five, and we're going to fire five questions at you. Jason, it's in your hands.
Great.
And the reason I want you to do this is if you ask anything that he doesn't like, he's not going to like you. But he'll keep we haven't had anybody push back. You know what? I will say this. I have to tell Jamie this because he knows our friend Byron Borger at Hearts and Minds. We did Take Five with Byron. He was in here in the studio with us. And I asked him a question. And in true Byron fashion, he like thought for a second and he goes, "I reject your question." And I mean, you can hear him saying that. And
see,
I have to say, you reject my question. It's not, you got to play fair. I'm making the rules here. You can't reject my question.
I think it was about his favorite book. Which,
that was it. Yeah, it was something
that's
like
exactly
that.
Exactly the question.
I think
that's
it was, if you were on a desert island besides the Bible, what book would you want? He goes, I reject the question, because he'd have a whole van load. That's the way it would work with him. So go ahead,
that's
Jason.
That's right. All right. Well, five questions. I'll start with a few. Again, they're fun, but it gives us a chance to get to know you a little bit more. So here's the first one. A book that we might be surprised by what you like. A book that would surprise us that you like.
That's a great question. Let's see, a book that would surprise you, probably Oscar Wilde's The Picture of Dorian Gray, which is probably kind of lame because probably not that many people know about that. But if you do any digging on Oscar Wilde, people will be surprised that I like that book.
Okay, excellent. That's great.
Now I have to read that.
Yeah. If Jamie read it, we got to read it.
Yeah.
Okay, second question. At a movie theater, which armrest is yours?
Both of them.
How did you?
Ding, 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 ding. Okay. Yeah, so why both of them?
No, I'm just, this is an old argument between my wife and I, and we have constant disagreements about the middle seat on the plane. Which she thinks if you're in the middle seat, you basically own the row as a compensation. So I think I'd probably take the left.
Yeah. By the way, on my flight on Sunday, there was a man in the middle who took that approach.
Yeah.
It was quite annoying.
I think it's fair. I think if you get stuck in the middle, you get both. I'm of that thought too.
I think if you get stuck in the middle, you should make your reservation sooner.
Exactly. Why should I have to pay for your lack of planning?
Right. There you go. I like that. That's a philosopher right there.
That's right. Okay.
Or a mansplainer or something.
Yeah. Okay, third question. If you had a choice between a comedy, drama, or action movie, which would you choose and why?
You know what? I would probably choose the comedy because I can't imagine watching a movie without my wife, and we would always just have more fun watching a comedy together. Yeah. Okay. I'm slightly embarrassed to admit that because I think I'm supposed to like these heavy philosophical dramas, but yeah, probably the comedy on a Saturday night.
Comedies can be philosophical at times.
That is true. That is a very good point, actually.
Okay. Quirkiest habit.
Quirkiest habit. So my wife constantly makes fun of me that whenever I get a fruit bottom yogurt, I take about 3 minutes to make sure that all of the fruit is evenly distributed throughout the yogurt before I start eating it. I know, that's all I got.
That's legit.
That's totally legit.
That is you need to go home and tell her. That is legit. Yeah. Nothing wrong with that.
Okay.
You're really finding out how boring philosophers are.
No.
Not at all. Yeah. Or how normal you are, because Walt and I agree with that. Yeah. Favorite free time activity?
I was going to say drinking cocktails, but that might get me in trouble. So I would say...
you can say whatever you want.
Yeah.
I actually love skiing.
Oh. Okay.
Snow skiing.
Yes. That's a great activity.
Yeah.
Let's go back to cocktails real quick. If you had to choose one favorite cocktail, what would it be?
Probably a Manhattan, though with bourbon instead of rye, unless I could get a really nice four-grain rye that would sort of give it some pop. And it has to have a Luxardo cherry in it.
Really? Wow. You're very specific. I like that.
Very specific.
That should have been your answer to the quirkiest habit question right there. And Kenton's a recent graduate of Lancaster Bible College. We had to get him out of here while you answered that for a little while. So
that's right.
Oh man. Well, that was good.
Anyways, thank you.
Yeah. For yeah. Good. So we get to know you a little bit better next time.
Sorry, that wasn't
right. No. That was great. That was awesome.
That was awesome.
Hey, let's go back to talking about the book You Are What You Love. And you were talking about liturgies. You've written about that a lot. I really think we need to tune into that and understand how liturgies work in our lives to shape us and to form us, you know, to reorient, you know, the trajectories of our hearts. One of the things you say in You Are What You Love is that we need to pay attention to forms. What do you mean by that? Pay attention to forms.
So on my reading, the way these cultural practices, these cultural liturgies shape you is not primarily because they're depositing content and ideas into your head. It's because they're taking you through these scripts that sort of work on you at this unconscious level so that you start absorbing an alternative vision of the good life without even realizing it. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So in a way it doesn't, it's less what you're being sold, for example, in the example of the mall. And it's more the way the whole sort of form of the practice, the very bodily scripts that you are taken through that are actually training your heart. They're like, they're orienting your heart to a rival vision of the good life. And so this is why I think Christianity has become overwhelmingly assimilated to American culture, mostly because we haven't realized what's at stake in the very form of that consumerism. So what we do is we think we are protesting the world when we come up with Christian forms of consumerism. so we sell all this Christian garbage. There are all kinds of Christian versions of the mall. And we think that because we're selling Jesus stuff, that it must be, you know, holy and good. And so, but really, if you look at the form of it, we still think stuff is going to make us happy. We are actually playing along with the consumerist gospel. So that's why I think we've been so focused on content that we think, oh, well, if we just change the content, then we're going to Jesus-ify these things. But actually, what you're doing is commodifying Jesus. And that's what worries me about, I think, that's happened to the church. I do think it's happened to youth ministry in a lot of ways, because we thought the forms of things were neutral containers, and then you could just kind of drop Jesus content into them and then everything's good. But what I'm saying is no, the form itself is already loaded. It's already primed in a certain direction. And if you put Jesus in that container, you're selling people something else.
Hmm. So what would some of those forms that, and you know, we've got to understand, people do this with good intentions. They think that this is
absolutely
a tool to effectively draw people and get them there to hear the gospel, or if it's an effective tool to use to channel and communicate the gospel. What are some of those forms or practices that you see that we believe are facilitating Christian nurture, but actually maybe undermining Christian nurture? And I think the reason I ask is, I think we do this a lot in youth ministry. Good intentions, and we're actually driving people away from Christian maturity.
And I do want to affirm your point that I actually think this is often very mission-minded, right?
Yeah.
It's with what we do is we do it in the name of being relevant and seeker-sensitive and attractional. And so what we do is we look at the kinds of cultural liturgies that people like, or that they're comfortable with, or that they're familiar with, and then we say, well, why don't we just communicate the gospel by those forms? I totally affirm the attention. I just think we might be missing what's at stake and what we're giving up in that. So I think the mall is an example. I mean, I could tell, and I won't even pick on youth ministry, because I have been to mega churches in the Midwest where if I sort of blindfolded you, walked you into a building and lifted the blindfold and asked you where you are, you wouldn't be able to tell me whether it was a mall or a church, right? So, and we think, oh, well, that way people will be comfortable. Yeah, people will be comfortable. And what they're going to, their posture is going to be, all right, there must be something here that's going to make me happy. Do you know what I mean? Like, there must be something here that's going to fulfill my sort of needs. I think other forms that we could sort of worry about here, since I care a lot about worship, I worry about how much we've adopted the form of the concert, the rock concert kind of form. And the problem with that is, this is not an anti-guitar argument. It's about the rituals that attend a concert that breed passivity and spectatorship in what is supposed to be the work of the people, which is worship. Mm. Or you could think of, I think, in some ways, the kind of coffee shop sort of form. I mean, there'd be different ways to think about it. The stadium is a very, very powerful cultural liturgy, and which really fosters incredible tribal instincts. and sometimes we uncritically just sort of import that into Christian ministries. And all I want us to see is we might be wheeling in a Trojan horse.
Oh, that's a good way of saying it. I like that. So let's go to maybe some forms that historically have been a part of the church, practices that have been part of the church all through history, that somehow in the last 30, 40, 50 years, let's say, have been forgotten in this age of consumerism and hypermarketing, and all done with good intentions, as you say, because I can't question the intentions of a lot of the people I chat with. But if you go to where I worship, where I'll be worshiping this Sunday morning, I can't tell you what our pastor will be preaching on, but I do know that we will pray the Lord's Prayer together. We will recite together the Apostles' Creed. We do it every week. We'll have a prayer of confession. I mean, there's more and more that we'll do there, obviously, just to mention those things. And many look at me like, you know, if you want to be culturally relevant, why do you gravitate towards this tradition, these forms, this dead ritual? But you would argue, actually, that there's an importance to repetition. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I would say there is no formation without repetition. So if our loves are habits, and that's the way the Christian tradition is always, love is a habit. That's why we call it a virtue, right? Virtues are good habits, dispositions, inclinations that we learn and acquire. And you can't acquire habits without repetition. So if you are so fixated on novelty and doing something new every week, you are forfeiting any possibility of formation, because there's no formation where there's no repetition. So this is what I think is part of the ancient wisdom of the body of Christ that has been handed down through the centuries. And I should say, I mean, a lot of what I'm trying to do here is translate the work of a scholar and teacher named Robert Weber. Is Bob Weber, is that a name that's familiar?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, he's a Philly guy.
Yeah. So Bob Weber, I think, nailed it when he talked about what he called ancient future worship. And this is, maybe this is the way to make the case. We're not talking about traditionalism. We're not talking about going back to the way grandma and grandma did it. I don't care about that at all. What I'm saying is the ancient biblical wisdom of the Christian tradition knew something about how formation works, right? And the spiritual disciplines and these liturgical practices that are handed down through the tradition are actually the most important way that we can be relevant, because we will offer the world a way to learn how to love God, right? That's what really is at stake here. And so when Bob says, you know, he talks about ancient future Christianity, what he means is the future of Christianity is found in our remembering these ancient practices, which are the most relevant thing that we can offer to our culture. Because, look, young people don't need another concert. They don't need another mall. They don't need another music video. They need what they're looking for is actually the strangeness of transcendence that is carried in these historic disciplines and practices. So, like you say, like to be a people who every single time we gather, we are encountered by a holy God and we meet him in confession, right? And we own our brokenness and we own our failures. That's a counterformative practice, because it goes against the cultural message that says, believe in yourself, you've mm-hmm. got everything. You know what I mean? Like this sort of Pelagian self-confidence. But what's equally countercultural is the fact that we will never confess our sins without the announcement of God's mercy and pardon and forgiveness. So when Jesus says, stand up, you are forgiven, I see you in the Son, that is equally countercultural, because there are all kinds of cultural liturgies that say how ugly you are, how fat you are, all the things that are wrong with you, you'll never amount to anything. And Jesus says, I see you in me, right? So to do that over and over and over again is to sort of let the gospel sink into your bones and get under your skin and become a habit for you, so that now you live in the world Christianly almost without thinking about it, right? The gospel is sort of is carried in your imagination at that point. This is why I think Dallas Willard's work, the spirit of the disciplines, the divine conspiracy, and so on and so forth, youth ministry needs to sort of dive into that. Richard Foster, Celebration of Discipline, all of that kind of work is just a treasure trove for thinking about what the formation of young people looks like. And my wager is I actually think our young people are pretty hungry for it. I don't think they want to be entertained. I think their parents think they want to be entertained, but I don't think our young people want to be entertained. I think they want us to take a risk on imagining that the gospel matters enough that we're not just going to make it fun. And I don't know. I've seen a lot of young people respond to that.
Yeah.
You're going right where I was going to ask, and I'm just even wanting to go maybe a little bit further with some of the direction that you're heading with, just some tangible things. We have youth workers that are listening, and I'm just really curious because you mentioned Foster, you mentioned Willard, both of whom their books have been tremendously foundational for my own faith. And I'm just wondering if there are some tangible things that we could give to those that are listening with regards to what's maybe taken from there or other things that you've found when it comes to some of these practices then in their own youth ministry.
Yeah. So I'm a philosopher, so when you ask for applications, I kind of suck. But
no, I'm going to argue with you on that because I think the book is full of them. Yeah.
Well, yeah. So a couple concrete things come to mind is, and it's not just on youth workers. Maybe that's the first and most important thing to say. I mean, I'm so sympathetic. I think what we ask of youth pastors is improper. And so the first thing I guess I would emphasize is to reconfigure how we even see youth ministry fitting in the body of Christ. And I think probably one of the most radical things we can do in youth ministry is recover multi-generational worship.
Yes. Yep.
So that already reconfigures the whole terrain. So when we stratified things generationally and sort of segregated the generations, I think that was the beginning of our problem. So imagine reconfiguring the entire congregation for multi-generational worship, bringing young people into the sanctuary to worship with us and to go through these practices. But then I can imagine youth ministry that is both, you know, a community of friendship, significance, meaningful, fun, and yet the spine of it is sort of organized around these practices, these spiritual disciplines. Like, what does it look like for a youth ministry to fast together during Lent, right? Like, what sort of hungers would we learn if we took up that sort of bodily practice? Or, yeah, what would it look like actually to let a youth ministry's calendar be dictated by the liturgical calendar rather than the academic calendar? I think we underestimate how different that could be. What would it look like to teach young people how to pray the Psalms? This is such a huge thing for me because I think this is going to sound a little bit on my soapbox, but I will say I think what pains me the most is when youth ministries unintentionally communicate that Christianity is just sort of extroversion for Jesus. Do you know what I mean? I think there are paradigms and models of piety that just collapse and identify following Jesus with being very exuberant and expressive and excited followers. And what worries me about that is that the kids who are introverted and wired contemplatively say, I could never do that. And because that's the only rendition of Christianity they see, they start to think they can't be Christians. Whereas if you, these are the students, some of the students I get to see here at Calvin College, if you teach them how to pray the Psalms, if you give them the Book of Common Prayer and say, you know, you can pray with the church using the Psalms, the hymn book of the Bible, and you don't have to make it up. Do you know what I mean? You can submit yourself to this discipline. It's like the gift of tongues. Do you know what I mean? Like you teach, yeah. They're like, are you serious? I can pray this way, and they will be very devout, and it's like, thank you for the gift of these forms that enable me to know how to follow Jesus without having to be the sort of spontaneous, expressive reality. I think there's a nice youth curriculum that Dorothy Bass and Craig Dykstra have put together called Way to Live, which is sort of it's kind of a little bit like Celebration of Discipline for young people. I think it could be contextualized in different ways, but I think it gives a signal of what it would look like for youth ministry to have this kind of liturgical spine to it without having to give up on fun, friendship, and so on.
Yeah. Do they have games in that book, Jamie?
Yeah.
I'm just joking.
I do think there are some.
No, I mean, that's what youth workers many times are looking for. Give me the latest game. This is... This wow. is so good. I would love in the future. I know our time is up. It's come to an end, but I would love in the future to be able to continue this conversation. And I want to say, Jason, what you just asked about, you know, some tangible things, certainly not just for youth workers, but for parents. They're the ones primarily responsible for the spiritual nurture. And I know quite a bit of the liturgical background or the history of what Jamie's a part of now and what he's talking about. And it's rich, you know. And what I want to say to youth workers as we close this out is that, you know, so much of what we do in youth ministry is about getting kids to youth group now. And what it really needs to be about is equipping them and preparing them for a lifetime of kingdom living and pursuing God and serving God. And I'm afraid, as Jamie has said, that so much of what we do unintentionally pushes back against that. So my challenge, as we've been talking about this book, You Are What You Love, The Spiritual Power of Habit, is that I do think it's a book that youth workers need to read. I also know that some youth workers probably who are listening, because of how we in youth ministry and in our own backgrounds have been formed, we may feel like, you know, writing this whole conversation off and pushing back. Don't. Consider this. Take time to work through this and ask God's Spirit to guide you as you go through. You know, read this book prayerfully regarding what Jamie's written about here. So, any other books besides your own? And we're going to put links up to all the books you've written. We're going to send folks over to Byron Borger at Hearts and Minds, where he will discount these, I'm sure. But anything else you'd recommend? Parents, youth workers, anybody who's interested in what you're talking about here.
In addition to the ones I mentioned, I think Way to Live is an interesting resource. And the other couple that come to mind are probably ones that are familiar to you and your listeners. One is by Kenda Creasy Dean at Princeton Seminary called Almost Christian, which I think is just a really both a helpful diagnosis of the cultural moment in which we find ourselves, but also an apologetic, if you will, for youth ministry that matters in the kinds of ways that we've been talking about it. And I still feel like we need to digest Christian Smith's work, sociologist at Notre Dame. So soul searching, souls in transition, that sort of legacy of showing how our current forms of youth ministry seem to not be doing the formational work that we want them to do. Yeah. I imagine that as kind of the scholarly parallel to what I'm trying to do on a more popular level.
Yeah. Well, and really what you're doing is you know, for those familiar with Christian Smith's work and then Kenda Creasy Dean, Almost Christian, you're really providing here, I believe, a clear and antidote to moralistic therapeutic deism, which I just really appreciate. So,
no, that's great. I think I love how you frame it. I mean, I think a lot of this is about patience and hope.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So, that's so good. I don't want you to judge my parenting by my 21-year-old. I definitely don't want you to judge it by my 17-year-old.
Oh man.
Because formation takes time.
Yeah. Oh,
right?
Yeah.
But there's also something about the covenant promises that God makes and seals in baptism, and that's where the hope comes in.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So if you're like me, you just lock your kids up and go on doing ministry. No, you know what? I'll tell you what I tell parents all the time, and we found this to be true because we have four kids, and they range in age from 32 down to 24, and that is that, you know, sound travels slowly. What you tell a kid when they're 15, they don't hear till they're 25. Or maybe in today's world, it's 30 or 35 with extended adolescence and such.
Yeah.
Thank you. Well, Jamie Smith, this has been great. We really appreciate what you're doing. Again, the book is You Are What You Love, and we'll include all those links. And we would love to have you back again sometime soon.
Yeah.
Keep writing. This is so helpful for all of us. And I told our guys here, you know, this is not to give you a pat on the back, but I said, you know, this is a voice that we need to be listening to, and we really believe that what you're saying is extremely valuable for us. So thank you so much. Jason, any parting words? No?
No, this has been great. Right, I'm excited to get Jamie back on the podcast. Yeah. It'll be fun.
Thanks so much, guys. It's been great to chat with you.
All right. Thank you. Thanks so much. And to everyone who's listening, thanks for joining us. And we'll talk to you on the next episode of Youth Culture Matters.
Thanks for joining us for Youth Culture Matters, a podcast from the Center for Parent Youth Understanding. If you'd like to learn more about today's youth culture, visit our website at cpyu.org. And if you have any questions, comments, or feedback, email us at podcast@cpyu.org.